Hello and welcome to the Society for Neo-Latin Studies podcast. My name's William Barton and I'm joined here today by Tommy Alho, currently a Marie Curie Fellow, also at the University of Innsbruck. Hi there, Tommy. Thanks for joining me.
Hi there, Will. Thanks for having me on here.
My pleasure. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about the place of Latin in the universities of early modern Britain. And I'm particularly delighted to have Tommy here with me for a chat on this topic, since Tommy's offered a series of significant contributions over the last few years. By way of introduction to the theme of Neo-Latin in British universities in general, with a selection of fascinating and accessible texts, we can refer you to the recent anthology edited by Gesine Manewald, our Society for Neo-Latin Studies President, and Lucy Nicholas, lecturer in Latin and Greek language and culture at the Warburg Institute, London. The anthology appeared in the Bloomsbury Neo-Latin series last year. So, Tommy, today we're going to take a closer look at a particular genre of early modern Latin poetry from the universities of Great Britain and Ireland that was produced over 400 years from the mid-16th to the late 19th century. This act and tripos verse, as it was known, was composed at the universities to accompany student disputations, which took place throughout the academic calendar. To contextualise this verse production a little bit more, I wanted to start by asking you a couple of questions about the culture of disputations at British universities more generally. So, how did these events look, Tommy? What did students have to do? And what was the point?
Well, by today's standards, the early modern disputation, or dissertation, appears a somewhat curious genre. Originally, it was a formal, essentially oral exercise, where the student had to demonstrate his mastery of the rules of dialectic and rhetoric rather than to present any new findings. However, over the course of the 17th and 18th centuries, what was originally a collection of orally defended theses transformed into self-sufficient pieces of research, as Kevin Chang has argued. Now, one distinction should be made. First, there is the printed dissertation, hundreds of thousands of which survived from the early modern period. And then we have the actual disputation. Unfortunately, we don't know very much about the physical disputation and how it relates to the printed dissertation. That's a rather complicated issue.
I see.
And one more qualification perhaps is needed. I'm now talking about the disputation system as it looked like in the Nordic countries and Central and Western Europe. However, we do know something, of course. The disputations took place in syllogistic form. Again, how and if this changes over the course of the 18th century, perhaps to a rhetorical syllogism or entomeme, and when the practice is given up altogether is unclear to me. Anyway, there were three actors in the disputation. It was usually the professor's duty to head the public disputation as prizes, while the student acted as the respondents, defending the thesis against his opponents. Also, there were several kinds of dissertations. I'll just mention the three most common ones. So for the public dissertations, commonly required before the student could proceed to the MA degree at the Faculty of Arts, there were the inaugural thesis pro exercitio and the master's thesis pro gradu. And then we had the doctoral dissertations pro doctoratu, which were defended at the higher faculties of theology, law and medicine. And to make things even more complicated, we don't really know who wrote the thesis. The professor, the respondent, or both together. But you would probably like to hear something about the British system, or perhaps the English system, because the English one differs again from the Scottish one, and so on.
I see.
Well, the bad news is that there were no printed dissertations in early modern England, only oral disputations. The good news, however, is that a few of them were recorded. And have survived to us. In addition to these, we have university statutes, list of printed disputation theses. These were indeed usually printed in Oxford, logic textbooks, and so on. So from these sources, we can draw a pretty good idea of what was going on at early modern Oxford. I already mentioned the logic textbooks. The most popular of these in 17th century England was Robert Sanderson's Logicae Artis Compendium from 1615. And it also contains an appendix on disputations, where Sanderson explains that it was customary to present a specific thesis at the British or English universities, such as metalla sunt in vitem transmutabilia, metals are mutually transmutable, or a question, an metalla sint in vitem transmutabilia. The question was put forward by the opponent or the moderator, whereas the respondent was to declare his opinion on the question in the so-called suppositio. There were two types of these suppositios, either a simple statement or affirmation or denial or a detailed account. Next, it was the opponent's turn. He started with a brief preliminary account of the matter called the oppositio before proceeding to his argument. And then it was again the respondent's turn, and then this went on until the time allotted for the disputation had elapsed or until the opponent had won the argument. And there were several kinds of disputations. So at Oxford, for example, the PA student had to attend regular disputations, kind of exercise disputations called in parviso. And after 2 years at university, he could attend the so-called pro forma disputations, and having also attended the necessary lectures, could then apply to be promoted to the degree of BA. For the MA, there were then four types of disputations: Lenten determinations, Quodlibet disputations, the so-called Austin disputations, and declamations. Finally, there were the disputations for the MA and the doctoral degrees, known as the Act in Oxford and as the Commencement in Cambridge. The Act consisted of two parts, the Vesperis and the Comitia. As I mentioned earlier, it became customary in the 17th century to print these disputation questions beforehand. There were three questions for each incepting doctor to answer, plus three philosophical questions for the future MAs to dispute on. So, for example, in 1619, one of the incepting doctors in theology had to dispute on the question, among others, an papa sit antichristus. Also, the correct answers to the disputation questions were printed, and the answer to the aforementioned question was naturally in the affirmative.
All right, so quite a formalized and complicated set of disputation requirements there. You mentioned already a couple of the literary outputs or written outputs of the academic context. But what were the other forms of written production that were also associated specifically with the disputation event itself?
Well, the act at commencement were accompanied by all kinds of peculiar ceremonies, speeches and so on. But perhaps I should specifically mention the so-called Terre Filius and Prevaricator speeches and the act on tripos verses. The Terre Filius and Prevaricator were kind of satirical, comical disputants, jesters, present at these graduation events. The disputant was known as the Terre Filius, that is, son of the earth, a nobody, in Oxford, and as Prevaricator, a dishonest advocate in Cambridge. Originally, at least, the role was to introduce a lighter tone to an otherwise ever so serious events by making fun of the disputation questions. But it happened that towards the second half of the 17th century or so, especially the Terre Filius speeches seemed to degenerate into whimsical attacks against the university establishment. I mean, they are sometimes really awful and mean. Felicity Henderson discusses one such rather very unpleasant piece in her paper, Putting the Dons in Their Place, a Restoration Terre Filius speech. However, such attacks seem to be largely absent from the 17th century Prevaricator speeches from Cambridge. On the other hand, I'm only aware of six such speeches that have survived to us. I think a good example of these Cambridge speeches is the one given in 1631 by the young James Duport, the future Regius Professor of Greek. The speech makes fun of the disputation thesis, aurum potest produci per artem chimicum, gold can be produced by the art of chemistry. Duport examines the thesis word by word and subjecting its term to scholastic scrutiny. It's actually really witty, not mean at all, and Duport's humour resides in his caricature of scholastic practices. Then there were, of course, the the Tripos verses already mentioned, but perhaps you, Will, could tell us a bit more about them.
Yeah, thanks, Tommy. Well, this verse, as I mentioned, was composed by students at the universities to accompany the disputation events. They took the various disputation questions, which you've mentioned a few examples of, as their theme and offered a poetic take on the question. Typical for the early modern literary scene in general, but especially important for academic verse, the dominant language of Acton Tripos verse was Latin. In some cases, ancient Greek was also used to give student versifiers an edge over their peers, we might say. To give an example of the bilingual production and the place of Greek alongside Latin in this context, we'll be presenting a diptych of anonymous verses on the same theme, one Latin, one Greek, in this episode. But from Cambridge, there's also mention of a poem produced in Hebrew that sadly hasn't survived. At Oxford, we know that the poems were read out at the start of the Act, which you've mentioned, or disputation days. But the example of Act and Tripos verses we're presenting today come from the University of Cambridge, where the poems, helpfully for us as historians, were circulated on printed broadsheets as entertainment and keepsakes for the audience of students and scholars, visiting academics, nobility, and other educated listeners. The authors of the Act and Tripos verses were usually the degree candidates, but we know that respected university poets were also drafted in to produce verse for their peers. They crafted clever, erudite, polemical, and sometimes, honestly, simply bizarre responses to their questions, designed principally to entertain, amaze, or impress the day's audience. But the poems also often reveal a refined and detailed understanding of the issues at stake in disputation, and regularly make complex allusion to contemporary political, literary, intellectual, and cultural events. I think this is the kind of thing we also see in the Terrae Filios and Prevaricator speeches. But now to turn to our poems specifically for today. These two were produced at the end of the 16th century for disputations in the theological faculty. The thesis under dispute was the following. Nemine licet sine externa vocatione exercere ministerium ecclesiasticum. No one should exercise ecclesiastic ministry without external calling. Well, what's this all about? In the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, England's religious and political landscape was tumultuous, as we see in other countries across Europe at the time. It was torn between Catholicism and the various shades of Protestantism active across the continent. Herself of moderate Protestant persuasion and surrounded by similarly minded advisers, Elizabeth's response to the turmoil she inherited was to attempt to steer an intermediate course between the rivaling positions. A key result of the decades-long discussion between religious leaders, theologians, and the court were the so-called 39 Articles of Religion, which attempted to offer a definitive statement of the Church of England's stance on numerous issues. The pair of poems we're reading today respond to Articles 22 to 24 in particular. The Church of England makes its via media, its middle way, on the debate over the necessity of an authorised external calling to ministry within the Church clear in these articles. This debate emerged in turn as a response to the reception of Lutheran ideas on universal vocation among Christians. According to this Lutheran view, if one felt moved by God internally to preach, one was justified in doing so. On the other side, for those groups which included Anglicans, Catholics, Calvinists, and other reformers who required external calling, the importance of civil legality in calling to ministry by superiors within the church alongside this internal motivation was strongly emphasised. All right, so let's have a listen to these verses, Tommy, and their translation, before we highlight a couple of particularly interesting themes and features. You'll read the Latin version of this poem first, and then I'll follow with the Greek.
Ne mini licet sine externa vocatione exercere ministerium ecclesiasticum. Quid tipi cum sacro paroista sacerrime verbo, rostraque quotu te scandere iure putas, quid net iam populo mysteria sacra propinas, et puerostingis scilicet euge facis. Siccine quetua mens alienane cotia tractas, et vetitum munus praecipi tanter opis. Quin potius solis istaecope unda ministris, non potes in clero laicus esse sinas. Est Deus in vobis agitante calescitis illo, non Deus est calorest, nec calorest furorest. Est Deus ad putius calor est sedet extasis una. Est calor absque Deo, cumque calore furor. Quid vis enim veteres, quod vix habuere profetae, vix Aaron nullo vis tipi iure darii. At Deus afflatum, quo telum fatice fingis, haud speciale tipi, credo diploma dedit. Praesulis imponenda, manus Deus hoc dedit illi, muneris hic ut eas, cum iubet irelicet. Ergo sacro sancti tractare oracula verbi, praesulis externa, non sine vocelicet.
Ελληνικός. Ο αυτόκλητος γερόν κύριος γραφών, ο αυτόμιστος διάκονος μυστηρίων, μπρεφόντε βαπτιστής, ο αυτεξούσιος, καυχόμενος περ την θεοπνεύστον χάριν, ειν μη παραντρών προσλάβει εξουσίαν, ενθουσιαστής εστίν, ου θεοπρέπος. Τον Ααρώνα και Ελισέον Θεός, τον μεν προφήτην τάσε, τον δ' αρχιρέα. Ον κρίσε τον μεν Μωσέης, τον δ' Ελίας. Και αντ Ιούδα Ματίας και Κλίατο, ψήφις αποστόλονται και κλήρης Θεού. Ουκ ενωμόστης εστί λειτουργός λόγου, ταχθείς ουέ Θεείο ανθρώπων δίχα. Let's hear the translations, Tommy.
Yes. No one should exercise ecclesiastic ministry without external calling. What do you want with a holy word, most sacred barrist? By what right do you think you are sent to the pulpit? Why don't you also hand over the sacred rites to the people? You baptize boys with the doctrine? Of course, great, you do it. So what's your plan? Do you do foreign business? And attend madly to forbidden services. Nay, rather, you should allow these matters to be dealt with by ministers on their own. You cannot be a layman in the clergy. Is God inside you? Are you inspired by him acting? It is not God, it is heat. It is not heat, it is madness. It is God, but a Puthian one. It is heat and a rapturing one. It is a heat without God, a madness with heat. But what do you want? What the ancient prophets rarely had. Not even Aaron. You want to be given this without any right, but God, by whom you pretend you are inspired in a frenzy, has not given you, I believe, a special permit. The hand of the bishop must be placed upon you. God has given this right to him. As part of his office, when he orders that you proceed, it is allowed to proceed. Thus it is not allowed to treat the prophecies of the Holy Word without the external call of the bishop.
Ελληνικός, in Greek. The self-proclaimed messenger of the holy writings, the self-initiated official of the mysteries, becoming a baptizer of newborns at one's own will, boasting indeed of God-given grace. If he's not also received the authorization from men, he's a zealot, not a holy man. God set up Aaron and Elisha, one as prophet, the other as archpriest. Of these, Moses anointed the one, Elijah the other, and Matthias was called upon instead of Judas by the votes of the apostles and the lots of God. He's not a rightful minister of the word who has been ordained by God at variance with men. All right, so We've got to imagine these poems being read out in front of university halls filled full of educated listeners, students and parents. And you can imagine these two poems getting quite a few laughs out. In particular, I think the satirical tone that both of the poems begin with and maintain, actually. In particular, in the Latin poem, I like this, scilicet oige facis. If it's like that, great, just do it. I mean, this is biting irony, and we see the same in the Greek poem. One specific thing that I do think needs comment is the mention of Peter Barrow in the first line of the Latin poem. We hear the word Barrowista. Well, this Peter Barrow was a Frenchman who arrived in England as a Huguenot, but altered his views later in life. He became Lady Margaret's Professor of Divinity at Cambridge. And when it came to the question of Reformed doctrine on predestination, Barrow took some views which were not in line with the general Anglican view. And the Archbishop of Canterbury, then John Whitgift, stepped in and confirmed the Church's position with a series of articles called the Lambeth Articles in 1595, and in the end, well, Barrow lost his job. So here he kind of stands for an educated but other view, which is unacceptable and here to be laughed at. Did you spot anything else in these lines which needed a bit of clarification, Tommy?
Well, I think at least there is the et pueros dignis, you bet the boys, literally. But the verb dingo, to wet, soak, moisten, was commonly used in Christian Latin for the act of baptism. So you baptize the boys. I think that's quite an interesting verb there. Another thing that comes to my mind is, of course, the esteus in vobis agitante kaleskimus illo. From Ovid's Fasti, only the nobis has been changed to vobis. Ovid was a very widely read author in those days, and this again, that you take a line from Ovid and change a word or a letter here and there was a very common practice, of course, in Neo-Latin literature.
And very satisfying, of course, for the audience as well, who would have been pleased and enjoyed hearing a line from a poet they recognise.
Indeed.
Well, the same is kind of true. The same sort of things are going on in the Greek verse, where we start with this ironic tone, o aftoklitos, hieron kyrux graphon, the self-appointed messenger. I think there the irony is pretty clear. And we get some other words here formed on the same pattern. O aftomistos diakonos. Aftomistos is here a simple compound word which is not attested anywhere else, but I think the meaning is clear, and obviously this is a flexibility that the Greek language will allow. At the very end, when this series of verses is making its final point, we hear a kind of switch in the language register with hypei theio, which is a Homeric or kind of epic language version of hypo theou. So this kind of underlines the sincerity and importance of the final two verses there, where the poet makes their point clearly and straightforwardly. Now the irony of the other verse is totally absent. Well, thanks, Tommy, once more for stopping by today and discussing these poems with me. I've had a lot of fun.
Thanks, Phil. So did I.
And if you want to know more about poetry from British universities and other literature produced there during the early modern period, please do check out the newest book from the Bloomsbury Neo-Latin series. And in the meantime, if you'd like to hear more material like this on the Neo-Latin world, please do check out the Society for Neo-Latin Studies podcast. Thanks and goodbye.
Bye-bye.